ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What would you do if you felt that your life and your family's life was in danger, real danger, from someone high up in the Russian government, a government which we know kills its opponents around the world? Well, this is the dilemma Nick Stride found himself in Russia, working for a very senior oligarch, Vladimir Putin's one-time deputy, no less. He felt his life was in danger and he fled to Australia. He leaked some information to a journalist, which led to a very embarrassing expose. And then when Australia's immigration officials wouldn't give him refugee status, he and his family hid in some of the quietest and most remote corners of Australia, in the north of Western Australia, places like the Dampier Peninsula, where they faced off against crocodiles, sharks, snakes, bushfires, and a cyclone. They had to learn how to kill wild animals just to survive. It's an extraordinary tale of survival against the odds. Sue Williams is the author. The book is called Run for Your Life, and its subject, Nick Stride, joins us now. Nick, welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks for letting me have the opportunity to tell my story.
It's quite a story, as we will discover. How did you find yourself in Russia? That might be the best place to start.
Yeah, I was actually back in Russia in 1998. So I'd just come back from a trip from Australia and got back to the UK and was looking for a good job. And that one just sprung up. My old boss was very pleased that I was going out to Russia for him.
I guess back then it seemed kind of like a land of opportunity, didn't it? It was changing so quickly. Felt as though the Cold War was long gone in the rearview mirror. Were you excited about the relocation?
I was. We knew absolutely nothing about Russia, and what the company told me was not very accurate. So when we got out there, it was almost like being on a different planet. There was no English anywhere. It was very difficult to communicate, and even buying food at the shops was extremely difficult.
Tell us about that. What did you find when you went to the shops back then in 1998? I'm just going to paint a picture of what life was like for you with this shift.
Well, the shops was a very, very long queue, and the queue goes up to a cabinet, and every product is hidden behind a cabinet. They have nothing you can actually pick up. So you have to queue to actually choose what you want, and then you'd have to go to another line to pay. And then you'd come to another line with a little bit of paper to say you've paid and to get your product. And there was times when I remember one of the first times I was really proud that I'd bought what I thought was a huge bit of cheese, and it turned out to be lard.
Oh, no. So
that was a big learning curve being out there.
So even though technically the Soviet Union had very much ended by 1998, it sounds as though the way of doing business was very much stuck in that era. They weren't the kind of modern supermarkets that are in Russia these days.
No, it was actually, it was a really good time to be out there, because I can remember loads of new things coming to Russia, like McDonald's, and also jeans hadn't been long in there, Coca-Cola, The Simpsons. I remember the first episode of The Simpsons being played on Russian TV, and there was one Russian voice done every single character. So it was not that great.
Yeah, I remember all the big bands went and played back then. I do remember the moment when the first McDonald's opened there as well. It did feel as though, you know, the metaphorical wall was down, and goodness knows it's up again these days. But it was a bright new hope. And you were there to work as a construction glazier, I understand. What exactly did you go to Russia to do?
My first job was working on the new British embassy in Smolensk, and I was just a supervisor in the chancery. Unfortunately for my company, which is why they like me so much, is nearly all the employees had some sort of criminal record.
Oh, gosh.
So to work in the chancery, there was only about four of us without a criminal record. So we were privileged to work in that part of the British embassy.
Yeah, I've got some friends who work in the diplomatic corps, and I understand that there are some parts of an embassy complex when you're building it, you've got to have people that are trustworthy who, I guess, aren't going to put in bugs and other things.
Well, one of the things when we were briefed, when we went out there by the British security, was that just because the Cold War has finished, it doesn't mean that maybe in 1 year time or 5 years time that it all starts up again. So the security actually builds year by year. So nothing ever really changes. So the chancery, yeah, you had to be English only and have a clear record. And it is one of the most secret parts of the embassy. Okay. So everything, even materials, had to come through an X-ray machine. Our tools weren't allowed inside or out. We were searched every time we went in there to make sure we weren't bringing things in. So it was very, very tight security.
Sounds like it. And quite prescient, really, of the experts to think that things might change soon in Russia. But reasonably early in your time in Russia, from what I understand, you met a young woman who you took a bit of a shine to.
Yeah, it was that one of my friends. It was his girlfriend's birthday, and she was having a party at Fat Mo's Jazz Club. And that's where I met Luda, and we just took even though we didn't speak the same language, we just took an instant liking to each other. And it was from that day, it was like every day we saw each other, and it just our languages grew together, and it was tremendous. It really was kind of love at first sight.
Oh, what a beautiful thing, crossing the kind of cultural divide and language, and sounds like a bit of a thunderbolt there in the jazz club. And you got married not long afterwards.
I knew that the future for us was going to be difficult, but being on, you know, a Russian and a UK passport, so after about 4 or 5 months together, and when I knew that the future was going to be difficult, we thought we'd go to the Far East, go to Thailand, spend 4 months together in each other's pockets. And if we come back very much still in love, then we'd sort of make a go of it for the future.
What a good system. I think that's a really good advice to
It was
to
a good holiday.
Quickly. Yeah, just go and spend every moment of every day together. And if you can cope with that, you can cope with just about anything. Goodness knows the relationship was in for some major tests going on. So before long after that, you ended up going back to England for a while, and you had a couple of kids there.
Yeah, we were very lucky. It actually took about 18 months to get Luda out of Russia. The system was very complex from the British side, actually, to get her into England. And she actually turned up. It was Christmas Eve. She was 8.5 months pregnant. Nobody knew, not even my mother, which was a huge surprise to her, but luckily a pleasant surprise.
Goodness me. And here she is suddenly being let in just in time for Christmas. It's kind of a beautiful image turning up, really. But before long, you decided it was time to go back to Russia again. You're offered a really interesting job back in Moscow. Tell us about that.
Well, a company hunted me down, and they knew that I spoke, by then I was fluent in Russian. One of the main things was I could actually live in Russia. It was very difficult for a lot of the lads out there to live and to just put up with that sort of way of life. So I was very much sought after, and there was a huge project going out there. Initially, I didn't know who it was for. It was just somebody very important. So I saw that as a great opportunity for Luda to get back into her own country. She was struggling quite a bit in England with the language, and I just saw it as a great thing for our family.
Turned out the project, building an extraordinary construction, a winter garden, I understand, was for someone very, very powerful indeed.
Yeah, the project was, my part of the project was project managing a huge glass dome, which had different temperate zones inside it, and a full-size Olympic swimming pool. And that was for the then Deputy Prime Minister, Igor Shuvalov.
Right, okay. So you're tasked on this project. And I guess, yeah, at first that must have seemed like an amazing opportunity to really get on well with one of these new oligarchs who was building the future of Russia, and as we know, very, very wealthy by that stage.
Yeah, extremely wealthy, and it showed. So it was a great opportunity, you know, and I enjoyed, like, the first year. I very much enjoyed working out there.
What was it like working for such a powerful person on such a big project? I guess there aren't a lot of, I'd imagine there weren't a lot of Olympic pools in private residences in Russia back then, or perhaps even now.
Well, it really was a money no object. Like the swimming pool, the actual basin part of it was made out of full stainless steel. And I'm not even sure if that's ever been done before.
Wow.
Because the cost is actually extraordinary. And, you know, to be part of that. And the other thing is, you know, I was the only non-Russian on that job, apart from the Uzbekistanis and Tajikistanis. I was the only foreigner, the Westerner, on that project. So I was seen as someone just a little bit special and under the wing and guardian of Igor Shuvalov.
Okay, so here on Nightlife around Australia on ABC Radio, my name is Dom Knight, and we're talking about an incredible adventure that Nick Stride and his family went on from Russia to the middle of nowhere in Australia. We'll get there before long, but at the moment we're just discovering why this was necessary, and my name is Dom Knight. So, Nick, there you go. You're in with one of the oligarchs, and his star was on the rise, wasn't it? He was very close to Vladimir Putin and had some pretty senior positions back then.
Yeah, there was, I remember all the lads getting excited, all the Russian managers getting excited because we heard news that, in fact, Igor was being put up to be the next president of Russia when Putin was going to step down. In the end, it turned out that job went to Medvedev. So he was a really big mover in the Kremlin.
Yeah, if I recall, there was a bit of a shuffle where Putin became prime minister or something. He couldn't have more than two terms in a row. And as we know, he's still very much there today. But it just goes to show, I guess, how close to the top your boss was. When did things start turning sour in terms of your work relationship there? When did you get the sense that things might be not quite so comfortable as you'd felt they were?
Probably about, it was a gradual process, probably about two and a half years in, I started to get more involved in the financial side for the client because his people, Russians are terrible at business, you know, they're really not very good at finances. And they'd often make mistakes. And instead of telling the client there's a problem, they'd come to me and go, Nick, have a look at this. What's the problem? Can you sort it out? And because it involved a lot of payments from Europe. And I'd go and look at the figures and find out what went wrong. And so I had access to a lot of the financial stuff, some of the offshore accounts and where the money is, was actually coming from. So 3 years in, I think the client's people were suddenly aware that, because they always saw me as not English. I spoke Russian, had a Russian wife, kids in a Russian school, and they thought that I was there for good. But then there was a sudden realization that that's probably not the case. And at some point I'll be going back to the UK, and I'll be going back to the UK with information that's probably just a bit tender to the Igor Shuvalov, the deputy prime minister.
So
they were starting to get
much
more and more anxious about me.
Mm. How did that show itself in the way that they treated you?
I actually went for a job interview in Georgia, in the southern state, Russian state Georgia, for Saakashvili. And I think they found out about it. I foolishly told them I was going to Spain to see my parents who lived there at the time. And I think that just really brought the anxiety on because they knew I'd been to Georgia. And so when I had to go back to the UK to renew my visa for Russia, they told me that I can go, my kids can go, but Luda stays in Russia. And when someone that you know is as powerful as who he is, when he tells you this is what you're doing, you have to do it. So he refused Luda exit from Russia. And then as time went on, he refused Michael and Anya to leave Russia until our lives were completely controlled by his people and we had no freedom or movement in and out of Russia.
Right. So you were essentially becoming a prisoner of sorts because you knew so much about his operations. And I guess they were worried about espionage or whatever else was going on. Were you ever approached by anyone about that? Was anyone in the UK ever saying, well, this guy's actually knows a great deal about a powerful person? Or did you fly under the radar with British intelligence?
To be honest, I'm really surprised that the British never approached me. It was I made so many trips back with the kids, and it always made me wonder that I used to go in and out of the UK as a man with two very young children, and I was never stopped.
Okay, well there you go.
And you think, like, you know, with a man taking kids out of England, so I was always like this paranoia, thinking like, is everybody watching me? And they're just keeping an eye out just to see what happens because, I'm very surprised the British never came up to us. But I think who knows where that could have gone.
Now, by this stage, if we zoom out to what's happening in Russia, things are a bit more sinister than the hope that you'd had back in the late 1990s when McDonald's was opening and jeans were arriving. Patterns of corruption were starting to set in by this point. The oligarchs had become more and more wealthy with their stainless steel swimming pools and so on. But also Putin was beginning to establish his stranglehold on the regime, and some of his opponents were dying. How worried were you at this stage that this sort of thing might happen to you, that your life itself might actually be in danger, given how much you knew?
I've been in and out of Russia for over 18 years, and I've seen it, you know, at times it's a mad, bad and real dangerous place to go. In the old days, there used to be Westerners murdered, and they never do it nicely. You see it on the television, and it's quite brutal. And I already witnessed on site a few incidents where people have actually disappeared, where they, you know, they haven't towed a line. So the only thing that can save you is money. If you have money, you can buy your way out, or at least buy yourself time. When you don't have money, that's when the danger comes. And we never had the money to protect us, and certainly not against people like the client's people.
Okay. So what made you decide that it really was time to leave Russia, if you possibly could, with yourself, your kids, and your wife?
It was when they refused for Michael Anya to leave. You know, that was a real turning point. That was like, now we're in, you know, a whole lot of trouble. So we had different sort of plans. We were thinking about driving, maybe going across the border to Belarusia or into Ukraine. I know we can buy our way over to get into Ukraine quite easily. So that was going to be one of the plans. But I started to work, and I didn't want to be caught at the border as well, because that would have been absolutely desperate for us. So I used to go to the client's people and say, like, just give me a Russian passport. I want to be Russian. I've had enough of going back to England. And I'd do this on a daily basis. And he'd always go like, the grass is not always greener. And I'm going, just give me a passport. And then a job come up in the Far East, a huge, huge job in a tax-free region, Far East. And I said, basically, look, I want that job. I want to do that job for you. And we agreed. That's when I told him, I'll do this job, but I have to go back to the UK with my family and sever my ties, say, you know, farewell to my family. We go over there, come back, we go out to the Far East. And he just went, yes, do it.
Wow. He thought you had stars in your eyes and rubles. You're going to do it for this big payoff in the East. But that wasn't your plan, was it?
It took 6 months of actually trying to convince him, of telling him that I hated England.
Gosh. Okay. So that must have been quite a big project. What did you do when you went back to London?
Well, when we left, we couldn't speak to anyone. Nobody knew. Even the kids didn't know what was happening. You know, we couldn't talk any. I know on site, the mobile phones are being monitored. My office on site was being monitored. And most likely, my apartment was also being monitored. That's just the norm of the way it is out there. So it was only me and Luda that actually spoke about what we were going to do. And what we wanted was to fly to England and make it look as though we've just gone back to England for this quick break. So we actually left with just hand luggage, nothing else. All the kids' toys, all our stuff just stayed in Russia. So when we got to the UK, we then bought 4 tickets to Australia.
Yeah. And you hit out, didn't you, when you were back in London? You went straight to the nearest hotel and basically no one knew you were there.
Yeah, no, nobody knew. They were expecting me the next following Monday. I think we went on the Friday. They were expecting me Monday, and we just we got the cheapest tickets from Royal Brunei Airlines, and that was in, I think it was like 3 days' time. So we just waited that time before we jumped on the airplane.
And there you were, this incredible tale of escape from Russia after things turned sour, both in the country more broadly, and for Nick Stride, working for the Russian oligarch Igor Shevalov on this construction project, but it turned out he knew too much. It's Nightlife around Australia on ABC Radio. My name is Dom Knight. What a tale this is, Nick. You must have been absolutely terrified. So you'd been to Australia, you mentioned earlier in the story. You'd been here when you were younger. What made you think that Australia would be the place to hide from Putin and his acolytes?
it's on the other side of the planet, basically. And, you know, I knew Australia. I liked it there. It's a great country. I knew being in England, I mean, the Shuvalov, he has property in London, you know. And is
they all do, the oligarchs, don't they? Or they did before the Ukraine.
Sorry.
Yeah, all the oligarchs had big property holdings in London, didn't they, once upon a time, before Ukraine?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was known as Londongrad. It's huge, huge amounts of money. And, you know, the property that he bought was actually part of the Queen's residence. So I knew if I was in London, I'd still be in his shadow and I'd be looking over my shoulder. So, you know, the choices of countries to go to is actually quite limited, possibly Canada, but Australia just fitted the bill. And I thought, just being that far away, he's probably got a lessen the amount that he's thinking about me. Because at that time, all it was, I hadn't done the expose with the journalists. It was just leaving that job with the information as well as not what he, it was what he thought I may have rather than what I actually had, because he would have suspected the worst.
And we know now, looking back on the UK, that that certainly was within range of Putin's regime, Alexander Litvinenko having been murdered with polonium in London. So it's a place where Russian security forces certainly seemed to operate back in the day. All right, so you find yourself in Australia. You get a visa at first. What do you do when you get here?
In Australia, our only goal was to spend a happy time together. Our only expectation after so long of being in stress and in fear was just to live happily for as long as we could. Yeah. And we knew we only had like a 6-month visa. And we thought, well, if we can just forget everything, be happy for 6 months, and then we'll hand ourselves in to immigration before we become unlawful. And we'll face that day, you know, when it comes. So it was, really was a matter of just enjoying that time in Australia as best we could.
A moment of peace and security before things start getting tough. How did you spend the 6 months? Did you achieve what you wanted to?
Fishing, camping, laughing, joking, swimming. It was absolutely brilliant. It was the first time and so many times that we could actually spend some idyllic time as a family together.
Absolutely. So you had a great 6 months. You lived the dream here in Australia. But as you mentioned, the clock was ticking. What happened when you got close to the 6 months?
We landed in Brisbane. And so we worked our way over the top through Darwin and then down into Perth. And then, you know, before our visas ran out, we stayed somewhere close to Perth and then just walked into the Department of Immigration, which is now Home Affairs, and just basically told them a brief story of what's happened to us.
And how did they respond?
The guy that we spoke to, his name was Carl. He was really nice, a compliance officer, and he was like a little bit overwhelmed. He was like, I can't believe this story. I can't believe I'm talking English. I don't need an interpreter to a refugee because you've got to go for political asylum. And I only told him really a very basic outline because I was very unsure what to say, you know, and I didn't really want to say too much that might expose me anyway. But there we applied for political asylum. But because we were a bit of an extraordinary case, he actually forgot to say that part of our entitlement as a political asylum and refugees that we would be, would have access to free legal representation. We walked out of that building, and once you exit the building, that no longer applies. So we couldn't have any sort of legal representation.
That's very, very rough. Now, you'd come to Australia 6 months earlier to try and escape from Russia and from the sort of long arms of these very powerful Russian officials. Was there any sign that they were after you during the 6 months when you arrived in Australia?
Yes, as soon as I arrived, the phone was going. I answered the phone. It was a very irate Russian who was making threats in some really good Russian swear language. And I just put the phone down. He phoned back. He was saying the same things again in Russian. And I just took the SIM card out. And I said to Luda, that's it. No calls, no emails, nothing. We're just going to try and put this behind us and basically just ignore it. And they could probably tell by the phone that I was in another country.
Okay. So you'd successfully disappeared. Now, As you said, the situation with the legal representation and so on wasn't handled ideally. How did things evolve after that?
We were initially turned down for protection, which is actually quite normal. Then it goes to the RRT, which is the Refugee Review Tribunal. And this went on over several months. And they actually stated that we had a justifiable fear of being returned to Russia, and which is huge. And we thought that was enough because, you know, they themselves were saying that, you know, they agreed to our fear. But the Department of Immigration in Perth didn't. And their stance was Luda had to go back to Russia and I was to be sent back and deported to the UK, which meant, you know, we'd lose Luda. The kids would lose their mother. I'd lose my wife. We'd never see her again. Apart from the fact that, you know, the day she lands in Russia, she's going to be in some terrible trouble, you know. So that just couldn't happen. The separation of our family just could not happen. And I can understand immigration's point of view because it was a huge catch-22 situation with us. But it was the way it was handled. It was so degrading working with Home Affairs in Perth, and they were really blunt. And they said some terrible, terrible things to Luda and to me.
And eventually, as this went on, the decision went up to the then Immigration Minister, Scott Morrison, himself. Did you have any luck there?
No, we actually had the guy, the American journalist who done the expose, which really ramped things up as well for the importance of keeping us safe. He actually wrote an email and a letter to Scott Morrison. But Scott Morrison, the problem is, I don't think Scott Morrison actually sees these things. It's all decided at the Home Affairs level on whether or not the immigration minister sees it. So we're really unsure whether he actually knew then about our situation. But we tried over several years with Peter Dutton, as well as Scott Morrison, and eventually Michaela Cash was, I think, acting as deputy immigration minister.
So let's talk more about the expose that you've mentioned. This is a big moment in the story. You saw that a leading journalist was poking around the affairs of your old boss, and you reached out to him.
Yeah, he actually already done a small expose, and I was looking at the information and I was thinking, like, he hasn't really got that much. And I know I've got on my hard drives probably a lot of information that he would find useful. And, you know, me and Luda, we spoke about it at length. Many nights we were talking about it. And, you know, we have a big duty to the Russian people. I mean, Luda's family's out there. My friends are out there. And, you know, these so few have so much riches. And, you know, I was actually part of that system. So there was a huge moral thing. And we knew by giving information to Michael Weiss that we would put ourselves in danger. But it just seemed the right thing to do.
And so this is for an article that gets published in Foreign Policy, one of the world's leading journals of international affairs, and Michael Weiss, the journalist, writes it up. So then, even though you've played this card, you've leaked the material, and you've basically done all you could to make the case that the man who was chasing you was very, very dangerous, Australia told you had to leave.
Yeah, and it was, you know, extremely, extremely blunt. And, you know, again, I can see the immigration point of view. I think, unfortunately for us, they kept playing good cop, bad cop. Carl, I actually, through the years, watched him progress from a compliance officer, and his job title was going up and up and up every time we'd see him over the years. It was quite impressive. He'd done really well. But the bad cop was Zach. You know, and he'd be constantly telling us, your only option is Luda gets sent back to Russia. And, you know, we pleaded with him and said, you know, this really, really can't happen. And the RRT said it can't happen. And one day on a meeting, he just turned around and said, you either do this the easy way or we'll do this a hard way. And I said, well, what's the hard way then, Zach? And he said, I'll put your wife kicking and screaming on an airplane if I have to. He said, what you've got to understand is Australia doesn't want you.
And this means, and from your perspective, she gets on the plane, that's it.
Yeah, that's the end of all of us. You know, she's not going to survive this. And, you know, and you can't argue, you know, this, it's no good trying to argue the point with them because it's just a brick wall. And we'd already had like the head of the British consulate come in and say that Luda can't go back to the UK because of her immigration history. So it was a huge catch 22, but it felt like, you know, Zach was punishing us because we couldn't resolve the situation and they couldn't resolve the situation. We just wanted to stay as a family. Yeah. I didn't care where it was. You know, they could have put us on a moon if they could have sent us to the moon together. But by trying to send Luda back to Russia was, you know, insane.
So you're both in grave danger, really. Luda, if she goes back to Russia, you, because you've leaked the secrets, you've probably painted a target on your back at this point. Australia saying you have to leave, we're kicking you out the easy way or the hard way. You and your family decide to run. What did you do?
Well, the last point I have to say is what Zach doesn't actually know is that, you know, I'm not stupid. I actually recorded every conversation that we had in Home Affairs, and he said a lot more. We, as much as we wanted to do the right thing, we had to protect ourselves. So when we came back from that interview, Luda cried for a week. She'd be sat in the corner. I look around, she sat in the corner crying. I've never seen anyone cry as much as she did. And not long after that, I think it was about 5 or 6 days later, I had a letter come through from Michaela Cash saying, there's no minister's intervention. They're not going to step in. And a day later, I had a phone call from Michael Vies, and he said, his article's going to go live tomorrow. And he goes, he's not sure of what the fallout is going to be with the client's people. And he goes, if you can find a hole, the deepest hole and the furthest place away, he goes, I suggest you find it now. And that was our ticket to move quickly. And the furthest place that we knew was going to be somewhere up in the Kimberleys.
And that's exactly what you did. It's on the front cover of this book about your story, Run for Your Life by Sue Williams. There's a map that shows the north of Western Australia and some of the places you found yourself after this decision to run, after being told that there was no home for you in Australia. How did you survive?
We up on a Dampier Peninsula, which is just north of Broome. We managed to look after an Aboriginal community. That's a very small campsite for John and Kathleen at Goombarrigan. So we stayed there initially for a few weeks. And then as soon as the communities knew there was this white family up there that was willing to lend a hand and can do construction and things, like, it was everyone wanted us.
Wow.
So we had the opportunity then to go to Banana Well, the Burgup Aboriginal Corporation. So we stayed there for three years looking after their campsite.
Okay, so you found some friends on the ground.
Yeah, so the great thing with the Indigenous communities on the peninsula is that they never asked questions. They just took us for who we were. And we learned so much from them. It was the Beagle Bay mob. I mean, they're great. So it was, you know, at times it was really, really enjoyable. But every day without fail in the morning, I'd look at the gate and think, you know, is this a day that some land cruiser is going to come through there and take it all away and destroy my family? It was extremely depressing. And, you know, the anxiety levels were extreme while we lived there.
So then at one point, more than 3 years after you were surviving as best you could and getting work wherever you could and shelter wherever you could, you decided you'd had enough, that it was time to come in and talk to the authorities again. What made you make that call that we really needed to stop this life on the run?
Well, at Burgup, Michael and Anya suffered. You know, they had very little social interactions with other children. Anya particularly was suffering. And, of course, Michael was getting close to being 18 years old. And I'd say to Luke, look, we just have to hand ourselves back in just to get the kids safe. You know, now the kids' lives are more priority than what my life is or what your life is. And she was extremely reluctant to go back to Perth, which is absolutely understandable. I mean, because she knew what was going to happen to her.
Yeah.
You know, but it was getting to a point where now lives matter. you know, our children's lives matter. So in the end, we moved to a very small community, Red Shells. And I said to Luda, let's just spend the next few months just enjoying life, forget everything. Then we'll hand ourselves in. And it was almost like the same time as when we reached Australia that we knew what we were going to face again. And then we realized that all the people around us that helped, they could face prosecution for aiding a fugitive, you know, and that couldn't happen. It was time to stop our lives affecting other people. So crazily or whatever, we moved to the beach away from everybody. And I sent an email to Home Affairs saying, come and get us. And I even gave them our exact longitude and latitude just in case they couldn't find us and got lost. And we thought we'd be on that beach for maybe a month or so, but they never responded.
Really?
I repeatedly emailed and they just did not respond.
Goodness me. That's an extraordinary part of the story.
Yeah, we lived. We survived. We had this old Hilux that we actually swapped for some fish with a local Aboriginal. It was a lot of fish, but the car had no brakes, no suspension, hole in the petrol tank. But Michael fixed it up from parts from Beagle Bay. And this was that was our only way off the beach. If that had broke down, and it often did break down, but we always managed to fix it. But the day that broke down was the day we were going to die, because you can't walk out of that situation. You won't be able to carry enough water to get out off that peninsula, off that beach. And so every day we were like, the Hilux became part of a family. We loved it to bits because it stayed with us and it looked as bad as what we probably did.
There's some incredible photos of the Hilux and of your campsite and how you're surviving during that period in the book. It's really, really adds some extraordinary detail. It's a place that almost nobody listening would have been anywhere near, I suspect. Here as we broadcast across the vast expanse of Australia, you've probably seen more different parts of the country than most people who live in Australia. But we need to bring your story to the conclusion to let everyone know that you're okay now, even though Australia never gave you asylum on a permanent basis. What happens after you then go to Home Affairs? I think you went to Bunbury, is that right?
Yeah, we managed to get off the beach, convinced Luda this was the best thing for the kids, and we got back to Perth. Back to Bunbury, handed ourselves in and thinking they may be a little bit more compassionate now, even just by looking at us, maybe. But no, it was the same thing. It's Luda going back to Russia and Luda just didn't cope. It was just too much for her. And she had a breakdown, which, you know, is the saddest day of my life that we were pushed to this. So Michael was just 18, but he was then lawful, and we wanted him to leave the country while he was a minor and unlawful. That was my responsibility. But as soon as he became 18, he becomes responsible for his own welfare. So he left Australia to go to Vietnam, hoping that he could then re-enter Australia on a working visa. But what we didn't know was when he exited Australia, they told him he had a 3-year ban. And I pleaded with immigration saying, like, no, I'm responsible when he was a kid. He's done the right thing. He's done the right thing, lawfully left Australia. And they said, no, because all your family's going to get a 3-year ban. So Michael was then stuck in Vietnam.
That's a very, very tough spot to be in after all that you've been through by this point, Nick. These days you live in New Zealand, and New Zealand has been more welcoming. How did you get
We managed to. I actually left Australia and left Anya in Australia to go get my son. And the plan was we'd either travel to somewhere like Canada or New Zealand. We had no money, so New Zealand was the cheapest and closest option and the best option for us. So me and Michael landed in Auckland with about $130 left. And we first approached the British Embassy, who just said, no, they're not going to help. And then we approached the New Zealand embassy. And I remember the first thing that they said was like, are you okay? And that's the first time someone said that to me. So New Zealand immigration are very strict, almost stricter than Australia, but extremely fair and compassionate. And so me and Michael, after over a year trying to prove our case. I have protection on convention grounds, and Michael has refugee status on convention grounds. You know, exactly what Australia could not give us.
So the two of you are safe. How about Anya?
Anya was in a terrible place. We couldn't actually get her out of Australia because of New Zealand law. When you claim refugee status, there's a ban on other family members entering the country until it's absolutely finalised. And so Anya just went through such a terrible time. She tried to commit suicide several times. She stopped eating for 3-4 months and was taken into the hospital. How she survived is absolutely incredible. But I plead with New Zealand, and they said they would actually fast-track Anya into New Zealand. So she's in the last-ditch attempt, she actually managed to get into New Zealand so the three of us could all be together.
My goodness, Nick, what a story. And the three of you are now safe there in New Zealand, I understand. Is that true? You're safe?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, we're always going to be looking over our shoulder, but that would be the same wherever we go. We tend to get itchy feet. We don't stay in one place too long. But with the protection in New Zealand, and New Zealand being, you know, a very isolated country as well, we feel about as safe as what we can do. And I'm not going to let any fear dictate the way I live my life now. You know, the book is actually, we spent 10, 15 years hiding from people, and this book is something that my family want to do so we can set ourselves free.
Well, it's a compelling story that you have. It's an extraordinary tale. Your relationship with Luda didn't survive this ordeal. Do you know how she is?
She's still in Australia. The relationship with her and the kids, it's not happening at the moment, but, you know, the kids are still trying. It's just been so much anxiety. Luda just went through so much. I think it's been extremely difficult for her. I know she still has visa problems even to this day. But, you know, that's kind of her story now. So I don't want to really speak too much for her or about her.
Of course. But at the end of this very long and challenging tale of your life following the decision to go to Russia, the three of you are safe and rebuilding your lives in New Zealand, and your tale is available for anyone who wants to read it. The book is Run For Your Life. It's by Sue Williams. And Nick, just amazing to have you with us and sharing so much of the ordeal that you've been through. I'm sure many listening will have had tears in their eyes as they hear and imagine themselves in your shoes. There's far more to the tale about how you survived for those 3 years and some of the hardships along the way there. Enormous thanks for being so generous with your time and with your story. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And thanks for letting us get our story out. It's a great opportunity and something we're all 100% behind.
That's Nick Stride. The story of his life and his escape is Run For Your Life. The author is Sue Williams. And look, if Nick and his family's story have raised any issues for you, please reach out to Lifeline. The number is 13 11 14, lifeline.org.au. You can also contact Beyond Blue.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.